Side 18.
The blackness rushed back to the zenith and was consumed. Sun and blue sky returned. The scene was the same. Surf, sand, palms, Magritte door, micro camera, frond, and her father. Those moving interstellar clouds and rings near the center of the galaxy. Aren't they due to periodic explosions around here? Isn't it dangerous to locate the station here? Episodic, not periodic. It only happens on a small scale. Nothing like the sort of thing we're doing in Cygnus A. And it's manageable. We know when it's coming, and we generally just hunker down. If it's really dangerous, we take the station somewhere else for a while. This is all routine, you understand?
Of course.
Routine. You built it all? The subways, I mean? You and those other engineers from other galaxies?
Oh, no, we haven't built any of it.
I've missed something. Help me understand.
It seems to be the same everywhere. In our case, we emerged a long time ago on many different worlds in the Milky Way. The first of us developed interstellar spaceflight, and eventually chanced on one of the transit stations. Of course, we didn't know what it was. We weren't even sure it was artificial until the first of us were brave enough to slide down.
Who's we? You mean the ancestors of your race, your species?
No, no. We're many species from many worlds. Eventually, we found a large number of subways. Various ages, various styles of ornamentation, and all abandoned. Most were still in good working condition. All we did was make some repairs and improvements.
No other artifacts? No dead cities? No records of what happened? No subway builders left? He shook his head. No industrialized, abandoned planets?
He repeated the gesture.
There was a galaxy-wide civilization that picked up and left without leaving a trace, except for the stations?
That's more or less right. And it's the same in other galaxies also. Billions of years ago, they all went somewhere. We haven't the slightest idea where.
But where could they go?
He shook his head for the third time, but now very slowly.
So then you're not...
No.
We're just caretakers, he said. Maybe someday they'll come back.
Okay, just one more, she pleaded, holding her index finger up before her, as probably had been her practice at age 2.
One more question.
All right, he answered tolerantly. But we only have a few minutes left.
She glanced at the doorway again and suppressed a tremor as a small, almost transparent crab sidled by.
I want to know about your myths, your religions. What fills you with awe? Or are those who make the numinous unable to feel it?
Oh, you make the numinous also.
No, I know what you're asking.
Certainly we feel it.
You recognize that some of this is hard for me to communicate to you.
But I'll give you an example of what you're asking for.
I don't say this is it exactly, but it'll give you a...
He paused momentarily, and again she felt a tingle, this time in her left occipital lobe. She entertained the notion that he was rifling through her neurons.
Had he missed something last night?
If so, she was glad. It meant they weren't perfect.
Flavor of our numinous. It concerns pi, the ratio of the circumference of a circle to its diameter. You know it well, of course, and you also know you can never come to the end of pi. There's no creature in the universe, no matter how smart, who could calculate pi to the last digit, because there is no last digit, only an infinite number of digits. Your mathematicians have made an effort to calculate it out to,
Again, she felt the tingle.
None of you seem to know. Let's say the 10 billionth place. You won't be surprised to hear that other mathematicians have gone further.
Well, eventually.
Let's say it's in the 10 to the 20th power place. Something happens. The randomly varying digits disappear. And for an unbelievably long time, there's nothing but ones and zeros. Idly, he was tracing a circle out on the sand with his toe. She paused a heartbeat before replying.
And the zeros and ones finally stop?
You get back to a random sequence of digits? Seeing a faint sign of encouragement from him, she raced on.
And the number of zeros and ones? Is it a product of prime numbers?
Yes.
11 of them.
You're telling me there's a message in 11 dimensions hidden deep inside the number pi? Someone in the universe communicates by mathematics? But help me, I'm really having trouble understanding you. Mathematics isn't arbitrary. I mean, pi has to have the same value everywhere. How can you hide a message inside pi? It's built into the fabric of the universe.
Exactly. She stared at him. It's even better than that, he continued. Let's assume that only in base 10 arithmetic does the sequence of zeros and ones show up, although you'd recognize that something funny's going on in any other arithmetic. Let's also assume that the beings who first made this discovery had 10 fingers. You see how it looks? It's as if pi has been waiting for billions of years for 10-fingered mathematicians with fast computers to come along. You see, the message was kind of addressed to us.
But this is just a metaphor, right? It's not really pi and the 10 to the 20th place. You don't actually have 10 fingers.
Not really. He smiled at her again.
Well, for heaven's sake, what does the message say?
He paused for a moment, raised an index finger, and then pointed to the door. A small crowd of people was excitedly pouring out of it. They were in a jovial mood, as if this were a long-delayed picnic outing. Ada was accompanying a stunning young woman in a brightly colored blouse and skirt, her hair neatly covered with a lacy gele favored by Muslim women in Yorubaland. He was clearly overjoyed to see her. From photographs he had shown, Ellie recognized her as Ada's wife. Sukhavati was holding hands with an earnest young man, his eyes large and soulful. She assumed it was Surinder Ghosh, Devi's long-dead medical student husband. She was in animated discourse with a small, vigorous man of commanding demeanor. He had drooping, wispy mustaches and was garbed in a richly brocaded and beaded gown. Ellie imagined him personally overseeing the construction of the funerary model of the Middle Kingdom, shouting instructions to those who poured the mercury. Vege ushered over a girl of 11 or 12, her blonde braids bobbing as she walked.
This is my granddaughter, Nina.
More or less.
My grand duchess. I should have introduced you before, in Moscow.
Ellie embraced the girl. She was relieved that Vege had not appeared with Mira, the ecclesiast. Ellie observed his tenderness toward Nina and decided she liked him more than ever. Over all the years she had known him, he had kept this secret place within his heart well hidden.
I have not been a good father to her mother, he confided. These days I hardly see Nina at all.
She looked around her. The station masters had produced for each of the five what could only be described as their deepest loves. Perhaps it was only to ease the barriers of communication with another appallingly different species. She was glad none of them were happily chatting with an exact copy of themselves.
What if you could do this back on Earth? She wondered. What if, despite all our pretense and disguise, it was necessary to appear in public with the person we loved most of all? Imagine this, a prerequisite for social discourse on Earth. It would change everything.
She imagined a phalanx of members of one sex surrounding a solitary member of the other, or chains of people, circles, the letters H or Q, lazy figure eights. You could monitor deep affections at a glance just by looking at the geometry. A kind of general relativity applied to social psychology. The practical difficulties of such an arrangement would be considerable, but no one would be able to lie about love. The caretakers were in a polite but determined hurry. There was not much time to talk. The entrance to the airlock of the dodecahedron was now visible, roughly where it had been when they first arrived. By symmetry, or perhaps because of some interdimensional conservation law, the Magritte doorway had vanished. They introduced everyone. She felt silly in more ways than one, explaining in English to the Emperor Quinn who her father was. But she dutifully translated, and they all solemnly shook hands as if this were their first encounter, perhaps at a suburban barbecue. Ada's wife was a considerable beauty, and Surinder Ghosh was giving her a more than casual inspection. Devi did not seem to mind. Perhaps she was merely gratified at the accuracy of the imposture.
"Where did you go when you stepped through the doorway?" Ellie softly asked her.
416 Maiden Hallway, she answered.
Ellie looked at her blankly.
"London, 1973, with Surinder."
She nodded her head in his direction. "Before he died." Ellie wondered what she would have found had she crossed that threshold on the beach. Wisconsin in the late 50s, probably. She hadn't shown up on schedule, so he had come to find her. He had done that in Wisconsin more than once. Ada had also been told about a message deep inside a transcendental number. But in his story, it was not pi or e, the base of natural logarithms, but a class of numbers she had never heard of. With an infinity of transcendental numbers, they would never know for sure which number to examine back on Earth.
"I hunger to stay and work on it," he told Ellie softly, "and I sensed they needed help. Some way of thinking about the decipherment that hadn't occurred to them. But I think it's something very personal for them. They don't want to share it with others. And realistically, I suppose we just aren't smart enough to give them a hand."
They hadn't decrypted the message in Pi? The station masters, the caretakers, the designers of new galaxies hadn't figured out a message that had been sitting under their thumbs for a galactic rotation or two? Was the message that difficult, or were they...
"Time to go home," her father said gently. It was wrenching. She didn't want to go. She tried staring at the palm frond. She tried asking more questions.
"How do you mean, go home? You mean we're going to emerge somewhere in the solar system? How will we get down to Earth?"
"You'll see," he answered. "It'll be interesting." He put his arm around her waist, guiding her toward the open airlock door. It was like bedtime. You could be cute, you could ask bright questions, and maybe they'd let you stay up a little later. It used to work. At least a little.
"The Earth is linked up now, right? Both ways. If we can go home, you can come down to us in a jiffy. You know, that makes me awfully nervous. Why don't you just sever the link? We'll take it from here."
"Sorry, Presh," he replied, as if she had already shamelessly prolonged her 8 o'clock bedtime.
Was he sorry about bedtime?
Or about being unready to denozzle the tunnel? "For a while, at least, it'll be open only to inbound traffic," he said. "But we don't expect to use it." She liked the isolation of the Earth from Vega. She preferred a 52-year-long leeway between unacceptable behavior on Earth and the arrival of a punitive expedition. The black hole link was uncomfortable. They could arrive almost instantaneously, perhaps only in Hokkaido, perhaps anywhere on Earth. It was a transition to what Haddon had called micro-intervention. No matter what assurances they gave, they would watch us more closely now. No more dropping in for a casual look-see every few million years. She explored her discomfort further. How theological the circumstances had become. Here were beings who live in the sky, beings enormously knowledgeable and powerful, beings concerned for our survival, beings with a set of expectations about how we should behave. They disclaim such a role, but they could clearly visit reward and punishment, life and death on the puny inhabitants of Earth. Now how is this different, she asked herself, from the old-time religion? The answer occurred to her instantly. It was a matter of evidence. In her videotapes, in the data the others had acquired, there would be hard evidence of the existence of the station, of what went on here, of the black hole transit system. There would be 5 independent, mutually corroborative stories supported by compelling physical evidence. This one was fact, not hearsay and hocus-pocus. She turned toward him and dropped the frond. Wordlessly, he stooped and returned it to her.
You've been very generous in answering all my questions. Can I answer any for you?
Thanks. You answered all our questions last night.
That's it?
No commandments? No instructions for the provincials?
It doesn't work that way, Presh.
You're grown up now. You're on your own. He tilted his head, gave her that grin, and she flew into his arms, her eyes again filling with tears. It was a long embrace. Eventually, she felt him gently disengage her arms. It was time to go to bed. She imagined holding up her index finger and asking for still one more minute. But she did not want to disappoint him. "Bye, Presh," he said. "Give your mother my love."
"Take care,"
she replied in a small voice. She took one last look at the seashore at the center of the galaxy. A pair of seabirds, petrels perhaps, were suspended on some rising column of air. They remained aloft with hardly a beat of their wings. Just at the entrance to the airlock, she turned and called to him. "What does your message say? The one in Pi?" "We don't know," he replied a little sadly, taking a few steps toward her. "Maybe it's a kind of statistical accident. We're still working on it." The breeze stirred up, tousling her hair once again. "Well, give us a call when you figure it out," she said. Chapter 21. Causality. As flies to wanton boys are we to the gods. They kill us for their sport. William Shakespeare, King Lear, 4-1-36. Who is all-powerful should fear everything. Pierre Corneille, Cinna, 1640, Act 4, Scene 2. They were overjoyed to be back. They whooped it up, giddy with excitement. They climbed over the chairs, they hugged and patted one another on the back. All of them were close to tears. They had succeeded. But not only that, they had returned, safely negotiating all the tunnels. Abruptly, amidst a hail of static, the radio began blaring out the machine status report. All three benzels were decelerating. The built-up electrical charge was dissipating. From the commentary, it was clear that Project had no idea of what had happened. Ellie wondered how much time had passed. She glanced at her watch. It had been a day, at least, which would bring them well into the year 2000. Appropriate enough. "Oh, wait till they hear what we have to tell them," she thought. Reassuringly, she patted the compartment where the dozens of video microcassettes were stored. How the world would change when these films were released. The space between and around the benzels had been repressurized. The airlock doors were being opened. Now there were radio inquiries about their well-being. "We're fine," she shouted back into her microphone. "Let us out. You won't believe what happened to us." The five emerged from the airlock, happy, effusively greeting their comrades who had helped build and operate the machine. The Japanese technicians saluted them. Project officials surged toward them. Davy said quietly to Ellie, "As far as I can tell, everyone's wearing exactly the same clothing they did yesterday. Look at that ghastly yellow tie on Peter Valerian." "Oh, he wears that old thing all the time," Ellie replied. "His wife gave it to him." The clocks read 15:20. Activation had occurred close to 3 o'clock the previous afternoon, so they had been gone just a little over 24. "What day is it?" she asked. They looked at her uncomprehendingly. Something was wrong. "Peter, for heaven's sake, what day is it?" "How do you mean?" Valerian answered. "It's today. Friday, December 31st, 1999. It's New Year's Eve. Is that what you mean? Ellie, are you all right?" Vege was telling Arkhangelsky to let him begin at the beginning, but only after his cigarettes were produced. Project officials and representatives of the machine consortium were converging around them. She saw Jurhir wedging his way to her through the crowd. "From your perspective, what happened?" she asked as finally he came within conversational range.
"Nothing. The vacuum system worked, the benzels spun up, they accumulated quite an electrical charge, they reached the prescribed speed, and then everything reversed."
"What do you mean, everything reversed?"
"The benzels slowed down and the charge dissipated. The system was repressurized, the benzels stopped, and all of you came out. The whole thing took maybe 20 minutes, and we couldn't talk to you while the benzels were spinning. Did you experience anything at all?"
She laughed.
"Oh, Ken, my boy," she said, "have I got a story for you."
There was a party for project personnel to celebrate machine activation and the momentous new year. Ellie and her traveling companions did not attend. The television stations were full of celebrations, parades, exhibits, retrospectives, prognostications and optimistic addresses by national leaders. She caught a glimpse of remarks by the Abbot Utsumi, beatific as ever. But she could not dawdle. Project Directorate had quickly concluded from the fragments of their adventures that the five had time to recount that something had gone wrong. They found themselves hustled away from the milling crowds of government and consortium officials for a preliminary interrogation. It was thought prudent, project officials explained, for each of the five to be questioned separately. Gerhier and Valerian conducted her debriefing in a small conference room. There were other project officials present, including Vege's former student, Anatoly Goldman. She understood that Bobby Bui, who spoke Russian, was sitting in for the Americans during Vege's interrogation. They listened politely, and Peter was encouraging now and again. But they had difficulty understanding the sequence of events. Much of what she related somehow worried them. Her excitement was non-contagious. It was hard for them to grasp that the dodecahedron had been gone for 20 minutes, much less a day, because the armada of instruments exterior to the Benzels had filmed and recorded the event and reported nothing extraordinary. All that had happened, Valerian explained, was that the Benzels had reached their prescribed speed, several instruments of unknown purpose had the equivalent of their needles move, the Benzels slowed down and stopped, and the five emerged in a state of great excitement. He didn't exactly say babbling nonsense, but she could sense his concern. They treated her with deference, but she knew what they were thinking. The only function of the machine was in 20 minutes to produce a memorable illusion, or just possibly to drive the five of them mad. She played back the video microcassettes for them, each carefully labeled. Vega Ring System, for example, or Vega Radio Facility. Quintuple System, Galactic Center Starscape, and one bearing the inscription Beach. She inserted them in play mode one after the other. They had nothing on them. The cassettes were blank. She couldn't understand what had gone wrong. She had carefully learned the operation of the video microcamera system and had used it successfully in tests before machine activation. She had even done a spot check on some of the footage after they had left the Vega system. She was further devastated later when she was told that the instruments carried by the others had also somehow failed. Peter Valerian wanted to believe her, to hear also, but it was hard for them, even with the best will in the world. The story the five had come back with was a little, well, unexpected, and entirely unsupported by physical evidence. Also, there hadn't been enough time. They had been out of sight for only 20 minutes. This was not the reception she had expected. But she was confident it would all sort itself out. For the moment, she was content to play the experience back in her mind and make some detailed notes. She wanted to be sure she would forget nothing. Although a front of extremely cold air was moving in from Kamchatka, it was still unseasonably warm when, late on New Year's Day, a number of unscheduled flights arrived at Sapporo International Airport. The new American Secretary of Defense, Michael Kitts, and a team of hastily gathered experts arrived in an airplane marked the United States of America. Their presence was confirmed by Washington only when the story was about to break in Hokkaido. The terse press release noted that the visit was routine, that there was no crisis, no danger, and that nothing extraordinary has been reported at the Machine Systems Integration Facility northeast of Sapporo. A Tu-120 had flown overnight from Moscow, carrying, among others, Stefan Beruda and Timofey Gotsrychy. Doubtless, neither group was delighted to spend this New Year's holiday away from their families. But the weather in Hokkaido was a pleasant surprise. It was so warm that the sculptures in Sapporo were melting, and the dodecahedron of ice had become an almost featureless small glacier, the water dripping off rounded surfaces that once had been the edges of the pentagonal surfaces. 2 days later,
a severe winter storm struck, and all traffic into the machine facility, even by four-wheel drive vehicles, was interrupted. Some radio and all television links were severed. Apparently, a microwave relay tower had been blown down. During most of the new interrogations, the only communication with the outside world was by telephone. And, just conceivably, Ellie thought, by dodecahedron. She was tempted to steal herself on board and spin up the Benzels. She enjoyed elaborating on this fantasy, but in fact there was no way to know whether the machine would ever work again, at least from this side of the tunnel. He had said it would not. She allowed herself to think of the seashore again. And him. Whatever happened next, a wound deep within her was being healed. She could feel the scar tissue knitting. It had been the most expensive psychotherapy in the history of the world. And that's saying a lot, she thought. Debriefings were given to Xi and Sukhavati by representatives of their nations. Although Nigeria played no significant role in message acquisition or machine construction, Ada acquiesced readily enough to a long interview with Nigerian officials. But it was perfunctory compared with the interrogations administered to them by project personnel. Vega and Ellie underwent still more elaborate debriefings by the high-level teams brought from the Soviet Union and the United States for this specific purpose. At first, these American and Soviet interrogations excluded foreign nationals. But after complaints were carried through the World Machine Consortium, the U.S. and the SU relented, and the sessions were again internationalized. Kitz was in charge of her debriefing, and considering what short notice he must have been given, he had arrived surprisingly well prepared. Valerian and Zerhir put in an occasional good word for her, and every now and then asked a searching question. But it was Kitz's show. He told her he was approaching her story skeptically but constructively, in what he hoped was the best scientific tradition. He trusted she would not mistake the directness of his questions for some personal animus. He held her only in the greatest respect. He, in turn, would not permit his judgment to be clouded by the fact that he had been against the machine project from the beginning. She decided to let this pathetic deception pass unchallenged, and began her story. At first, he listened closely, asked occasional questions of detail, and apologized when he interrupted. By the second day, no such courtesies were in evidence. So the Nigerian is visited by his wife, the Indian by her dead husband, the Russian by his cute granddaughter, the Chinese by some Mongol warlord. Quinn was not a Mongol. And you, for Christ's sake, you get visited by your dearly departed father, who tells you that he and his friends have been busy rebuilding the universe, for Christ's sake. Our Father who art in heaven. This is straight religion. This is straight cultural anthropology. This is straight Sigmund Freud, don't you see that? Not only do you claim your own father came back from the dead, you actually expect us to believe that he made the universe. You're distorting what... I'll come off it, Arroway. Don't insult our intelligence. You don't present us with a shred of evidence, and you expect us to believe the biggest cock and bull story of all time? You know better than that. You're a smart lady. How could you figure to get away with it? She protested. Valerian protested also. This kind of interrogation, he said, was a waste of time. The machine was undergoing sensitive physical tests at this moment. That was how the validity of her story could be checked. Kitz agreed the physical evidence would be important, but the nature of Arroway's story, he argued, was revealing a means of understanding what had actually happened. Meeting your father in heaven and all that, Dr. Arroway, is telling, because you've been raised in the Judeo-Christian culture. You're essentially the only one of the five from that culture, and you're the only one who meets your father. Your story is just too pat. It's not imaginative enough. This was worse than she had thought possible. She felt a moment of epistemological panic, as when your car is not where you parked it or the door you locked last night is ajar in the morning. You think we made all this up? Well, I'll tell you, Dr. Arroway. When I was very young, I worked in the Cook County Prosecutor's Office.
When they were thinking about indicting somebody, they asked 3 questions.
He ticked them off on his fingers.
Did he have the opportunity? Did he have the means? Did he have the motive?
To do what?
He looked at her in disgust.
But our watches showed that we'd been gone more than a day, she protested.
Ah, I don't know how I could have been so stupid, Kit said, striking his forehead with his palm. You've demolished my argument. I forgot that it's impossible to set your watch ahead by a day.
But that implies a conspiracy.
You think she lied? You think Ada lied?
What I think is we should move on to something more important. You know, Peter, Kitz turned toward Valerian, I'm persuaded you're right. A first draft of the materials assessment report will be here tomorrow morning. Let's not waste more time on stories. We'll adjourn till then.
Derheer had said not a word through the entire afternoon session. He offered her an uncertain grin, and she couldn't help contrasting it with her father's. Sometimes Ken's expression seemed to urge her, to implore her. But to what end, she had no way of knowing. Perhaps to change her story. He had remembered her recollections of her childhood, and he knew how she had grieved for her father. Clearly he was weighing the possibility that she had gone crazy. By extension, she supposed, he was also considering the likelihood that the others had gone crazy too. Mass hysteria, shared delusion, folie à cinq.
Well, here it is, Kit said. The report was about a centimeter thick. He let it fall to the table, scattering a few pencils.
You'll want to look through it, Dr. Arroway, but I can give you a quick summary, okay?
She nodded assent. She had heard through the grapevine that the report was highly favorable to the account the 5 had given. She hoped it would put an end to the nonsense.
The dodecahedron, apparently, he laid great stress on this word, has been exposed to a very different environment than the benzyls and the supporting structures. It's apparently been subjected to huge tensile and compressional stresses. It's a miracle the thing didn't fall to pieces. So it's a miracle you and the others didn't fall to pieces at the same time. Also, it's apparently seen an intense radiation environment. There's low-level induced radioactivity, cosmic ray tracks, and so on. It's another miracle that you survived the radiation. Nothing else has been added or taken away. There's no sign of erosion or scraping on the side vertices that you claim kept bumping into the walls of the tunnels. There's not even any scoring, as there would have been if it entered the Earth's atmosphere at high velocity.
So doesn't that confirm our story? Michael, think about it. Tensile and compressional stresses? Tidal forces? Are exactly what you expect if you fall down a classical black hole. That's been known for 50 years at least. I don't know why we didn't feel it, but maybe the dodec protected us somehow. And high radiation doses from the inside of the black hole and from the environment of the galactic center, a known gamma ray source. There's independent evidence for black holes, and there's independent evidence for a galactic center. We didn't make those things up. I don't understand the absence of scraping, but that depends on the interaction of a material we've hardly studied with a material that's completely unknown. I wouldn't expect any scoring or charring because we don't claim we entered through the Earth's atmosphere. It seems to me the evidence almost entirely confirms our story. What's the problem?
The problem is you people are too clever.
Too clever. Look at it from the point of view of a skeptic. Step back and look at the big picture. There's a bunch of bright people in different countries who think the world is going to hell in a handbasket. They claim to receive a complex message from space. Claim? Let me continue. They decrypt the message and announce instructions on how to build a very complicated machine at a cost of trillions of dollars. The world's in a funny condition. The religions are all shaky about the oncoming millennium, and to everybody's surprise, the machine gets built. There's one or two slight changes in personnel, and then essentially these same people... It's not the same people. It's not Sukhavati, it's not Ada, it's not Chi, and there were... Let me continue. Essentially, these same people then get to sit down in the machine. Because of the way the thing is designed, no one can see them and no one can talk to them after the thing is activated. So the machine is turned on and then it turns itself off.
Once it's on, you can't make it stop in less than 20 minutes, okay? 20 minutes later, these same people emerge from the machine, all jaunty jolly with some bullshit story about traveling faster than light inside black holes to the center of the galaxy and back. Now suppose you hear this story and you're just ordinarily cautious. You ask to see their evidence. Pictures, videotapes, any other data. Guess what? It's all been conveniently erased. Do they have artifacts of the superior civilization they say is at the center of the galaxy? No. Mementos? No. A stone tablet? No. Pets? No, nothing. The only physical evidence is some subtle damage done to the machine. So you ask yourself, couldn't people who were so motivated and so clever arrange for what looks like tension stresses and radiation damage? Especially if they could spend $2 trillion faking the evidence? She gasped. She remembered the last time she had gasped. This was a truly venomous reconstruction of events. She wondered what had made it attractive to Kitts. He must, she thought, be in real distress. I don't think anybody's going to believe your story, he continued. This is the most elaborate and the most expensive hoax ever perpetrated. You and your friends tried to hoodwink the President of the United States and deceive the American people, to say nothing of all the other governments on the earth. You must really think everybody else is stupid. Michael, this is madness. Tens of thousands of people worked to acquire the message, to decode it, and to build a machine. The message is on magnetic tapes and printouts and laser discs in observatories all over the world. You think there's a conspiracy involving all the radio astronomers on the planet? And the aerospace and cybernetics companies? And no. You don't need a conspiracy that big. All you need is a transmitter in space that looks as if it's broadcasting from Vega. I'll tell you how I think you did it. You prepare the message and get somebody with an established launch capability to put it up. Probably as an incidental part of some other mission. And into some orbit that looks like sidereal motion. Maybe there's more than one satellite. Then the transmitter turns on and you're all ready in your handy-dandy observatory to receive the message, make the big discovery, and tell us poor slobs what it all means. This was too much even for the impassive to hear. He roused himself from a slumped position in his chair. "Really, Mike," he began, but Ellie cut him short. "I wasn't responsible for most of the decoding. Lots of people were involved, Drumlin especially. He started out as a committed skeptic, as you know, but once the data came in, Dave was entirely convinced. You didn't hear any reservations from him." "Oh, yes, poor Dave Drumlin. The late Dave Drumlin, you set him up. The professor you never liked." Jurheer slumped still further down in his chair, and she had a sudden vision of him regaling Kitts with second-hand pillow talk. She looked at him more closely. She couldn't be sure. "During the decrypting of the message, you couldn't do everything. There was so much you had to do. So you overlooked this, and you forgot that. Here's Drumlin, growing old, worried about his former student eclipsing him and getting all the credit. Suddenly he sees how to be involved, how to play a central role. You appeal to his narcissism and you hooked him. And if he hadn't figured out the decryption, you would have helped him along. If worst came to worst, you would have peeled all the layers off the onion yourself." "You're saying that we were able to invent such a message?" "Really, it's an outrageous compliment to Vega and me. It's also impossible. It can't be done. You ask any competent engineer if that kind of machine, with brand new subsidiary industries, components wholly unfamiliar on Earth, you ask if that could have been invented by a few physicists and radio astronomers on their days off. When do you imagine we had time to invent such a message, even if we knew how? Look how many bits of information are in it. It would have taken years." "You had years, while Argus was getting nowhere. The project was about to be closed. Drumlin, you remember, was pushing that. So just at the right moment, you find the message. Oh, then there's no more talk about closing down your pet project. I think you and that Russian did cook the whole thing up in your spare time. You had years." "This is madness," she said softly. Valerian interrupted. He had known Dr. Arroway well during the period in question. She had done productive scientific work. She never had the time required for so elaborate a deception. Much as he admired her, he agreed that the message and the machine were far beyond her ability, or indeed anybody's ability. Anybody on Earth. But Kitz wasn't buying it. That's a personal judgment, Dr. Valerian. There are many persons, and there can be many judgments. You're fond of Dr. Arroway. I understand I'm fond of her, too. It's understandable you would defend her. I don't take it amiss. But there's a clincher. You don't know about it yet. I'm going to tell you. He leaned forward, watching Ellie intently. Clearly, he was interested to see how she would respond to what he was about to say. The message stopped the moment we activated the machine. The moment the Benzels reached cruising speed. To the second. All over the world. Every radio observatory with a line of sight to Vega saw the same thing. We've held back telling you about it so we wouldn't distract you from your debriefing. The message stopped in mid-bit. Now that was really foolish of you. I don't know anything about it, Michael. But so what if the message stopped? It's fulfilled its purpose. We built the machine and we went to where they wanted us to go. It puts you in a peculiar position, he went on. Suddenly she saw where he was headed. She hadn't expected this. He was arguing conspiracy, but she was contemplating madness. If Kitz wasn't mad, might she be? If our technology can manufacture substances that induce delusions, could a much more advanced technology induce highly detailed collective hallucinations? Just for a moment it seemed possible. Let's imagine it's last week, he was saying. The radio waves arriving on Earth right now are supposed to have been sent from Vega 26 years ago. They take 26 years to cross space to us. But 26 years ago, Dr. Arroway, there wasn't any Argus facility, and you were sleeping with acid heads and moaning about Vietnam and Watergate. Oh, you people are so smart. But you forgot the speed of light. There's no way that activating the machine can turn the message off until 26 years pass. Unless in ordinary space you can send a message faster than light. And we both know that's impossible. I remember you complaining about how stupid Rankin and Joss were for not knowing you can't travel faster than light. I'm surprised you thought you could get away with this one. Michael, listen. It's how we were able to get from here to there and back in no time flat. 20 minutes anyway. It can be acausal around a singularity. I'm not an expert on this. You should be talking to Ada or Vega. Thank you for the suggestion, he said. We already have. She imagined Vega under some comparably stern interrogation by his old adversary Arkhangelsky, or by Baruda, the man who had proposed destroying the radio telescopes and burning the data. Probably they and Kit saw eye to eye on the awkward matter before them. She hoped Vega was bearing up all right. You understand, Dr. Arroway? I'm sure you do. But let me explain again. Perhaps you can show me where I missed something. 26 years ago, those radio waves were heading out for Earth. Now imagine them in space between Vega and here. Nobody can catch the radio waves after they've left Vega. Nobody can stop them. Even if the transmitter knew instantaneously, through the black hole, if you like, that the machine had been activated, it would be 26 years before the signal stops arriving on Earth. Your Vegans couldn't have known 26 years ago when the machine was going to be activated, and to the minute. You would have to send a message back in time to 26 years ago for the message to stop on December 31st, 1999. You do follow, don't you? Yes, I follow. This is wholly unexplored territory. You know, it's not called a space-time continuum for nothing. If they can make tunnels through space, I suppose they can make some kind of tunnels through time. The fact that we got back a day early shows that they have at least a limited kind of time travel. So maybe as soon as we left the station, they sent a message 26 years back into time to turn the transmission off. I don't know. Oh, you see how convenient it is for you that the message stops just now. If it was still broadcasting, we could find your little satellite, capture it, and bring back the transmission tape. That would be definitive evidence of a hoax. Unambiguous. But you couldn't risk that. So you're reduced to black hole mumbo-jumbo, probably embarrassing for you. He looked concerned. It was like some paranoid fantasy, in which a patchwork of innocent facts are reassembled into an intricate conspiracy. The facts in this case were hardly commonplace, and it made sense for the authorities to test other possible explanations. But Kitz's rendition of events was so malign that it revealed, she thought, someone truly wounded, afraid, in pain. In her mind, the likelihood that all this was a collective delusion diminished a little. But the cessation of the message transmission, if it had happened as Kitz had said, was worrisome. End of side 18.